Okay, so if what I was going to say is that if for some reason you want me to interrupt the normal course of the presentation, don't hesitate. I will lower this. Don't hesitate. We can always raise this and continue on the blackboard or do something less automatic than this computer generated presentation. By the way, I'm just an hologram that is also generated by the computer, and I'm having lunch at the student center at the very right moment. Okay, more seriously, what I'm going to tell you is about some work that we did with Art Chitra, which is now in Jussieu, and Pierre Le Doussal from the ENS, concerning Wigner crystallization. And let's say, although this thing can apply in essentially any situation, three dimension, even one dimension, I will focus here on the example of Wigner crystals that have been realized experimentally, and these are of course the one that have been done in the two-dimensional electron gas. So I hope that this qualifies for nanostructure and I'm not completely off the main topics of the conference by giving this talk. So essentially, what is the idea, or what is the question that has come out in the last years? And I think this question has been reinforced by the discovery of the so-called metal insulator transition in two dimension by essentially the group of Kravchenko. Is what happens in two dimensions when you take electrons, and of course you have the Coulomb interaction, and you add disorder. And there are limits where we know what is supposed to happen. Of course, if the interaction is zero, then we all know that there is Anderson localization. We all know that all the states should be localized, maybe with a localization length that is the diameter of the universe, but at least they should be localized. Hi, Marcus. And then if the interactions are weak, essentially one expects this Anderson localization not to be affected too much by interactions, and to keep the description of, let's say, free fermions plus disorder valid for a while, although we all know that when you put interaction and there is disorder, both of them conspire to give you extremely dramatic effects, so it's not clear what happens even for weak interactions. Then when you crank up the interaction, one enters sort of no man's land where nobody really knows what is happening. I think it's one of the most exciting subjects that is existing at the moment. People are happily killing each other to know whether delocalization should take place or not take place in the middle, and I'm very clearly not going to answer that. What I'm going to try to do is to crank up the interaction even more and go to a regime where one expects the interaction to be so strong that the electron, in the absence of disorder, would crystallize, and this is something that has been predicted by Wigner, I would say, in the last century. Now I can tell it. In the last century. And of course, in this regime, one expects to have better handle to try to understand what are the effects of disorder on the electron gas. So instead of trying to tackle the problem from that side, I will tackle it from the other side, and as I learned from Leon in a talk, this is the right approach. Well, remember this joke? Well, okay. To get a Wigner crystal, what you can do is to reduce the density of electrons, and this is the way that Wigner sort of decided it in three dimensions. You just simply weaken the kinetic energy enough so that the interaction is dominant. Or there is another and maybe smarter idea, which was used to get also Wigner crystal, which is to kill the kinetic energy with the magnetic field. And therefore, you can expect to get Wigner crystal if you take, let's say, a two-dimensional electron gas and put it under a very strong magnetic field. Of course, you know that you will get lambda levels and interesting physics associated with the fractional quantum Hall effect. But if you crank up the magnetic field strongly enough, then you expect to get the Wigner crystal. Now, the question which I think is important with the Wigner crystal is how do you know that you get a Wigner crystal in a system? Normally, when you get a crystal, what you have is that you have relatively powerful imaging techniques that enables you to really know that you have a crystal in your system. You can do X-ray, you can do neutron diffraction, and this is something that has been used a lot to study regular solid, which has been used a lot to study, for example, vortex lattices, and people have some idea there that indeed there is good crystalline order in the system. But when you deal with the two-dimensional electron gas, as far as I know, nobody has been able so far to really give you an image of the electron distribution in the system. And I think clearly for experimentalists, this is one of the challenges that is in this field, to try to have an imaging technique that would be comparable to X-ray or neutron scattering experiments or decoration experiment for the vortex lattice in order to probe the positional order of the two-dimensional electron gas. But unless we have such a technique, the only probe that we have to decide whether one gets Wigner crystallization or not in such system is through transport measurement. And it's a very indirect probe. It's not very easy when you measure the resistivity of something to decide whether the stuff has good positional order, the electrons have crystallized, or whether you get, electrons in plane wave state. So what it means is that in addition to the experiment, you need a theory which is able to go from the basic nature of the electrons. So either the electrons are in plane wave state, plus interaction, plus disorder, or they are in Wigner crystal state, plus disorder. And this theory is able to relate this structure of the electrons to the thing you can measure, which is essentially the DC transport, both the linear and the nonlinear transport. You can measure the IV, the full IV characteristics. The AC transport, which is also a measurement you can do, you can measure the conductivity as a function of the frequency, and of course, especially if you have a magnetic field, the Hall transport. And these are essentially the three probes that you have at your disposal. They are more sophisticated, a variation on the theme. Of course, instead of measuring the steady state conductivity, you can measure the shot noise. But this is all transport experiments for the moment. So clearly, for the theorists, the job to do is to go from whatever is your favorite description of the electron gas, plus disorder, plus interaction, and try to compute these quantities. If you can do this, you can relate to experiment in some way. So the quest for the Wigner crystal is something which is rather old. And usually at that point, I put a slide, which is another joke. It's not easy to know that you have a Wigner crystal. And there is a very famous paper which at some point claimed to have maybe seen a Wigner crystal, and this is a paper by Tsui, Stormer, and Gossard, where they saw this quantization of the whole plateau at fractional multiple of the quantum of Hall conductance, and in the abstract they say, oh, maybe Wigner crystallization is the explanation for that. I take it as an example that, when you look at the transport experiment, you don't know really what it is. Okay, here it turned out to be more interesting in some sense than the Wigner crystal, but you really need a probe to tell you that you get the Wigner crystallization. So here are early experiments that I think were the first to really sort of detect the Wigner crystal in the two-dimensional electron gas. So this is essentially quantum Hall systems where you get your 2D electron gas, you put a very strong magnetic field, let's say 20 Tesla on it, and how can you decide that you have a crystal, or try to decide that you have a crystal? The first experiment that was done in the Sackley group by Eva Andre and Tito Williams, and what they did, they send sound waves on the crystal and on the 2D electron gas, and checked that there were absorption at places which were consistent, and you will see what I mean by that, which were consistent but what you would expect for the vibration mode of a crystal. Because they know the wave vector of their sound, they know the energy of their sound. So if the omega versus k relation for absorption matches what you expect in the crystal, then it's a good indication that the density in your system is not homogeneous, but that you do get the correct vibration mode. There are more conventional transport experiments that were done by our Stormer group at Bell Labs, where you clearly see this is the longitudinal resistance. These are the dips of the fractional plateaus, and you clearly see that if you crank up the magnetic field large enough, you simply shoot up in resistivity, both in the longitudinal resistance and in the Hall resistance, and therefore you get a state which is an insulator. Now again, what is this insulating state? You don't know, but you might expect that this is a Wigner crystal that has been pinned by impurities. You can do a little better job than that in trying to go to check further for a crystal. And the thing is that, for example, here is the nonlinear IV characteristics. So this is the current versus the applied voltage. So you apply an electric field, which tend to make your crystal slide. And then you measure the velocity at which it slides, which is simply the current. And if it's a crystalline structure and there are impurities in the system, you expect it to remain pinned, not to move, until you exceed some threshold of force that you have applied to the crystal. And therefore, you expect to see this kind of nonlinear IV characteristics here, where the current is zero unless you exceed a certain electric field, and then the system is starting to move. When you hit the system, you see a more conventional characteristic. Now, finally, there have been recently by the Princeton group and by the group in Saclay also measurement in the optical conductivity. So this is simply the sigma xx conductivity as a function of the frequency. And when you do that, you clearly see a maximum of conductivity at a frequency which is at a given characteristic frequency. And then, loosely speaking, this is also what you expect when you have a pin crystal, because you expect to have your elastic structure being held by the impurities, and therefore you can imagine sort of harmonic oscillator in a well which has a resonance frequency, and this resonance frequency will show up a maximum of absorption here at so-called pinning frequency. So these things are sort of indications that indeed in this system you get a Wigner crystal. So now what you can do is try to see whether, in fact, you can compare these things in a more detailed way with experiments. And as you will see, it doesn't work. If you try to make a basic theory, as was done, nothing works with the experiment. And then you can wonder whether what you see is really a Wigner crystal or not. So how do you want to describe such a Wigner crystal? The idea is very simple. When you deal with the electron gas, if you try to keep the whole fermionic nature of the electron gas, you will be sunk. There is no way you can put the disorder, the interaction, the Pauli principle, and so on and so forth. Fortunately for you, if you are deep in the crystal phase, you don't need to do that. Because deep in the crystal phase, the electrons are well localized at given position, so they become discernible by their position. So they become essentially, quote, classical particles, in the sense that you don't have to worry too much about anti-symmetrization of the wave function anymore. So if you're deep in the crystal phase, you can forget about the exchange. And essentially, you want to describe your system with sort of classical particles that will take equilibrium position on a triangular lattice. And the size of this particle will be the extension of the fermionic wave function, which has a certain size. Here I've written it, I've called it LC, because I have in mind the system on which you apply a strong magnetic field, and then the size of the particle is essentially the cyclotron radius for the electron. But of course, even if you had a system without a magnetic field, then the extension of the fermionic wave function would have a given size, which now I can still call LC, but which will not be dependent on the magnetic field the way the cyclotron radius is. But this is an important characteristic length scale of the problem. Then you have a second one, which is the lattice spacing. And again, what I say here about forgetting exchange is certainly true if LC, the size of the particle, is much smaller than the lattice spacing. So this is certainly well valid when you are deep inside the crystal phase. Now the first question is how deep you need to be. This is a very interesting question. I don't know the answer to this question. The only answer I can give you is a sort of rule of thumb, which is that if you want to describe the melting of crystals, there is a criterion which is known as Lindemann criterion, which says that you compute the vibration of the particle away from their equilibrium position, and when this vibration reaches some fraction of the lattice constant, then the crystal melts. And the fraction of the lattice constant is empirically determined to be something like less than 0.1. So at the melting of normal crystals, the extension of the wiggling of the particles is less than 10% of the interparticle distance. So in my personal view, but this is something clearly that would need to be investigated better, essentially this picture of the crystal should apply even pretty close to the melting transition of the crystal. So it's not something you have to be 10 kilometers away from the boundary between the liquid and the crystal, but this should apply even relatively close. So then, if you take this picture, then the situation is very nice, because then you get your little particles with their equilibrium position. You can model them by a displacement. You can say that they are away from the equilibrium position by a displacement that I call U, and then you will model the system by a quantum crystal. So you will do an elastic description of this system, and again, you have to keep in mind that there are three important characteristic length scale. I already mentioned two. One is the size of the particles, and you will see that this is really crucial. The second one is the lattice spacing, which here is simply related to the density of particles. And then if you add disorder on the crystal, there is an additional length scale, which is the distance on which your disorder potential is correlated. In principle, nothing would prevent the disorder to be correlated over length scale which are much larger than the lattice spacing of the system. And theorists always like to take delta function correlated potentials, something where V at some point x prime averaged over disorder is simply delta of x minus x prime. But in fact, this delta function has to be regularized, and there is a characteristic length scale which is the width of this delta function. And here you have to take it again as a parameter in your system. So these are essentially the three length scale that we will keep in our description of the Wigner crystal. Now then it's very easy, because again you have a stupid elastic Hamiltonian. You just write the elastic Hamiltonian you will find in all textbooks, you know, whether you take Landau-Lifschitz or whatever, with simply two little twists. One is that you have Coulomb interaction. So you have to distinguish between the longitudinal displacement that changed the average density of the system in one point, which will couple to the long wavelength part of the Coulomb interaction, and the shear displacement, which simply shift the particle with respect to one another, do not change the average density of the system, and therefore do not couple to the long wavelength part of the Coulomb interaction. But this is a relatively straightforward thing. And then, of course, you want to quantize the elastic vibration of this crystal, just like you do for, you know, normal phonons. And all this leads you to the following Hamiltonian action for the system. So for the longitudinal displacement, you get the standard omega square plus q square lo. But since they are sensitive to the long wavelength part of the Coulomb interaction, you have an additional term which is growing as q. And this is the plasmon in two dimensions. This is simply telling you that if you try to compress the 2D gas at some place, then the relation between energy and wave vector is that omega is equal to square root of q and not linear in q. This is simply the plasmon. In one dimension, it will be essentially logarithmic. Okay. And in three dimensions, it will be a constant. The transverse modes, which are the shear modes, are only sensitive to the short distance part of the Coulomb interaction, so they have the standard linear dispersion relation, which is that omega is proportional to q. This is the standard elasticity that you have in a crystal. And then, of course, if you have a magnetic field, you have to add the Lorentz force, and the Lorentz force contributes to the action by a term which is essentially coupling the velocity cross b times the displacement, and this gives you this coupling between the longitudinal and the transverse mode, because of course if you start moving that way, then you start moving sideways in the system, so you will immediately see that you couple the longitudinal and the transverse mode. If you think in terms of XY, this would be sort of XY coupling in the system. And again, this Lorentz force is proportional to omega C. Omega C is the cyclotron frequency of the system. It's essentially the magnetic field divided by the mass of the system. Okay. Now, this is the simple elastic Hamiltonian, and of course, if you want to deal with the disorder system, you have to add the disorder on the top of it. Okay? Now, let's first examine the consequence of this description for the pure system. Well, for the pure system, it's very simple. If you have a magnetic field, then if you don't have a magnetic field, then your system is a perfect conductor. So the conductivity as a function of frequency has a peak at omega equals zero here. Which means that if you apply, this is linear response, but it just means that if you applied an electric field, your system would slide without being held by any type of disorder. If you put a magnetic field, then what you find is that this peak moves to a finite frequency. What does it mean? It simply means that if you have a magnetic field, then your electrons are running into circles with a characteristic frequency, which is the cyclotron frequency. So there is no net current that is able to flow to the system. So the omega equals zero conductivity is zero. But if you apply a finite frequency, then the system can resonate when the frequency is equal to the cyclotron frequency. Okay. So this is the optical conductivity you should see for a pure system. If the system were a Wigner crystal, you should see a peak at the frequency, which is the cyclotron frequency, which again is simply the magnetic field. The whole conductivity is equal to the classical value, and simply 1 over b here.
The peak which resonates is the whole center of mass.
Yeah, this is, if you have a pure crystal, then of course all electrons slide together. They have no reason to change their spacing when you apply a uniform electric field. So essentially, the whole center of mass of the system is moving as a, the system is sliding as a unit, as a rigid body, if you want. If you wanted to sort of make different part of the system move different ways, you would need to apply an electric field which is Q dependent. Of course, all this will change when you put the disorder. When you put the disorder, different region of space will be held in different ways by the disorder. Okay. Now, if you look at the eigenstate of the system, you saw that you have two modes, one which has a dispersion which is omega square equal Q, the other which is omega square equal Q square. The Lorentz force coupled the two, so the eigenmodes are essentially the square root of this product of the two modes. So this is Q times Q square, and this makes eigenmodes which have a dispersion which is omega going as Q to the 3/2. And this was the relationship that was used in the Sackley group experiment to probe that you had the Wigner crystal. But of course, all this is for a pure system, so you can wonder how much when you put disorder, the disorder will change this property. So now we go to the crux of the matter, which is we have our model, and we need, in presence of disorder, to be able to relate this model to the transport experiment. If what we predict with this model for the transport experiment work with what is observed, then we have good reason to indeed believe that what is in this system is a Wigner crystal. If not, then you can wonder whether something more exotic is going on. Okay, so what was the conventional, and of course it's a complicated problem. Once you add the disorder to this elastic Hamiltonian, you're essentially sunk. So the conventional wisdom to treat this, and this is something which has a very, very long history, and I'm not going to review the history of this. I can refer you to various places in the literature where this has been done. In particular, there is a review written with Edmond Aurignac, which is on CONMAT, on disorder quantum crystals, which is published by Kluwer. So if you want to have more details, please have a look at that. But the idea is the following. What happens when you take a crystal and you put it into disorder? It was shown essentially first by Larkin that there is essentially, because of the disorder, a destruction of the perfect positional order of the crystal. And this is something that has been rediscovered, if I can say, or discovered in various other situations where you had this kind of competition between elasticity and randomness. And this was something that occurred in charge density wave and was investigated by Fukuyama and Lee, and which occurred in randomizing model and was investigated by Imri and Ma. And essentially, scaling arguments showed you that if you look whether there is a length scale for which the displacement in the crystal become of the order of the lattice spacing, you find that below four dimension there is such a length scale. And let me call this length scale RA. And the naive idea is that if you have this length scale, then when the displacement become of the order of the lattice spacing, it means you have lost your crystal. And so the sort of conventional wisdom was that you, when you put disorder in your system, you broke the crystal, whether it was a classical or a quantum crystal. And for classical crystal, this picture was used heavily to describe vortex lattices, for example, by Fisher and Hughes. And the idea was that if you had your crystal plus disorder, then essentially the system will break into little pieces of a characteristic size RA, this length scale for which the displacement are of the order of the lattice spacing. And of course, this length scale is dependent on disorder. The weaker the disorder, the larger this length scale becomes. Now, it's even worse than that because, again, the conventional wisdom was telling you that because of the disorder was breaking the crystal into little blobs, it would introduce enough strain between the blocks to sort of destroy an elastic description of the crystal. So defects, dislocations would appear between these blocks and would completely kill the positional, the relative positional order between these blocks. So essentially, the sort of conventional description of a disordered crystal was that you had a crystal broken into crystallites, small crystallites of size RA, and essentially these crystallites would behave as, quote, independent objects. Okay. Now, what are the consequences? For example, there is a whole body of literature following this approach for the classical crystal, on which I'm not going to enter. But let me focus on what happened for the Wigner crystal. Now, what does it mean for the optical conductivity? It would mean that if you look at the optical conductivity, each one of these blocks will behave as a sort of independent rigid object moving in this spinning potential that has broken it into pieces. So each one of these blocks, if you try to shake it out of its equilibrium position, will sort of have a resonance at a certain pinning frequency, which I will call omega p, which is a function of its size, which is a function of the characteristic length scale at which it has been broken, if you want. So the idea, the conventional wisdom, is that the sigma xx would have a peak now at a pinning frequency, which is a certain function of this length scale RA. And of course, because each different block is pinned with a slightly different size, with slightly different forces holding it into place, the perfect delta peak would not exist. And essentially, this peak would be broadened. And the way it's broadened, by the way, is difficult to compute. So essentially, people assume a Lorentzian broadening of the peaks. So essentially, if you take this conventional vision of a disordered elastic system, what you would get is that you should replace the conductivity of a perfect crystal, which would be a delta function here at omega equals zero if you don't have a magnetic field, or a delta function somewhere there at the cyclotron frequency if you had a magnetic field, by something which has zero conductivity here, and because it's held in place by the disorder, and then as a peak at a characteristic frequency, which is omega p, which is fine, because this is roughly what is observed in the experiment. Remember the curve that I showed you on optical data? This is what you see. You see roughly a peak at a certain characteristic frequency. So now what you want to check is in detail whether this description works. You take this description, and of course you know what RA is because it's given by scaling analysis, so you know what omega p is, and in particular, if the disorder is fixed, you know how RA depends on the density, so you can compute theoretically how the pinning frequency should behave as a function of the density. You know how this pinning frequency behaves when you have a strong magnetic field, and essentially it's behaving as a constant, which is density dependent, divided by the cyclotron frequency, so now you know the magnetic field dependence. And does it work? Well, the answer is essentially no. And it doesn't work, it's not a disagreement which is quantitative. It's a totally qualitative disagreement, in the sense that the predicted pinning frequency should grow as a positive power of the density, the measured dependence of the pinning frequency, if you assume that what is observed is the pinning frequency, is decreasing with the density, with a negative power, and depending on the regime and whatever, it's either minus 1/2 or minus 3/2. I would not put too much faith on the precise fitting of the exponent, but in any case, it's a negative power of the density. If you look at the magnetic field dependence, instead of decreasing with magnetic field as it should do here, if this formula were correct, you find that the pinning frequency increases as a function of magnetic field. So now there are two attitudes you can have with this result. The first one is that you have tried an elastic description of the system plus disorder, so Wigner crystal plus disorder, you have made detailed prediction. Predictions are not verified experimentally, so it means that the system is not a Wigner crystal. And therefore, one should look for more exotic description of what happens at very large magnetic fields or very small density of this phase. This is a little bit shocking because we know that if you decrease the density enough or if you increase the magnetic field enough, you should get a Wigner crystal. So the second attitude is to say, well, these theoretical results are simply wrong because essentially the conventional wisdom that has been used to go from the elastic model towards the transport is wrong. And you have to find what is wrong here and to find how to make the correct theory for the transport starting from the elastic Hamiltonian. Okay. So this is, of course, the thing that I'm going to try to present to you. Okay, so the question is still there, which is how do you sort of tackle the problem when you have to deal with an elastic problem plus disorder? So I'll skip technical details. If you're interested in the technical details, we can always do them on the blackboard or whatever. But the idea is essentially there are two methods that one can use. One is a variational method, and the other is a renormalization group calculation. I will sort of skip this technical detail. But just to show you what kind of problem we have to deal with, let me show you here the kind of Hamiltonian or action one has to deal with. You start with an elastic action here, and then you add the coupling to disorder, and you can easily check that the coupling to disorder is essentially something which is, this is the density, and there is a way to represent the density as a function of some exponential of the displacement field, in a way that I'm not going to detail here, times some random potential. Now, when you have such a disorder model, you want to get rid of the random potential as soon as possible, and the only trick you have at your disposal here is to use replicas, because the Hamiltonian is not linear in the displacement. You cannot use supersymmetry. You can use dynamical methods, but these are usually more complicated. So if you can avoid them, you avoid them. And you get rid of the disorder using replicas, which leaves you with this horrible looking Hamiltonian, where now you have n coupled fields, which are, if each one is described by some elastic energy here, and they are coupled through this horribly nonlinear coupling, which is a cosine type coupling. The two replica indices here are coupled. If you are on a classical problem, because the disorder is purely local, the coupling is purely local. Unfortunately, if you deal with a quantum problem, the disorder is time independent, which means that when you average over the replicas, then your coupling coupled two replica indices at same point, because the disorder is local in space, but at two different times. So you get this quite horrible non-local coupling in time, and you have to deal with this Hamiltonian. So the way you do it is essentially by, one way to do it is essentially by trying to find the best quadratic Hamiltonian that you can find that will be an approximation of this horribly non-linear Hamiltonian. And this is a standard type of Feynman, I would say, variational method, which is, let me take a trial action, which is essentially some unknown variational parameters, which are the Green's function of my system, which depends on the replica indices, the frequency, the momentum, and phi is some kind of, phi is essentially the displacement here for this problem. And then what you do is that you, through this best trial Hamiltonian, you can determine a variational free energy, which is simply the free energy of the trial Hamiltonian plus the average of the true action minus the variational action computed with the variational action, and you find the best optimal variational parameters by minimizing this variational action. So this gives you a set of kind of nonlinear equations for this G here. Essentially G minus 1 is omega square plus Q square. This comes from the free part of the action, plus some exponential of G itself, which comes from averaging the cosine and so on and so forth. So you have to solve this, and of course you have to solve them because it's a disordered problem, and also take the limit n goes to 0, which is the limit in which the replicas give you back the disorder term. So there are two ways you can do it, and I don't want to enter into the details, but either you can take a trial action which is replica symmetric, which is the thing you would like to try naturally, or you can realize that the system will sort of exhibit properties which are close to the one of a glass, and then you have to try replica symmetry breaking in this system. And in fact, the replica symmetry breaking solution is the one which is the one which gives the correct physics. So depending on the dimension, you have to break replica symmetry in different ways. If people are interested in that, I think it's better to discuss it in private. I won't discuss the physical interpretation of the replica symmetry breaking solution for this problem. But to some extent, you're happy to see that your variational solution is giving you replica symmetry breaking, because this is what you expect. You have this competition between the elastic energy that wants the system to be well ordered and the disorder that wants to really make the system scrambled. And essentially, you know that this will lead to glassy properties. You will have many competing ground states, you will have many competing metastable states, and somehow your variational solution should be able to reproduce that to give you the right physics. So when you do that, because then after you have a quadratic action, you can compute everything you want, and in particular you can compute the transport properties. So let me just show you plots of the optical conductivity that are realized for various essentially densities here. And this is the experiments that has been done by the Princeton group. You can see for yourself that at least the qualitative shape of the curve is strongly reminiscent of what you get in the experiments. And there are various features that you can check out there. The first one is that you clearly see that there is a non-Lorentzian broadening, in the sense that you do get peaks at a certain frequency, which is the pinning frequency, but clearly the broadening is asymmetric. And this is something you clearly see on the experimental peak. Of course, the narrow peaks look much more symmetric, but on the other one, you clearly see that essentially the tail here is broader on one side than on the other side.
The sigma is just a measure of the disorder.
Sorry, what is sigma? Yes, sigma is a measure of the disorder in this problem. Yeah, essentially, in the absence of magnetic field, sigma would just be the pinning frequency. In presence of magnetic field, it's a slightly more complicated thing. But yes, this is dependent on the disorder. Essentially, there are two parameters you can vary in this system. Unfortunately, the disorder, you have very little control. Experimentally, I mean, on it, but you can vary the magnetic field and you can vary the density. And they affect things in different ways. The density changes the lattice spacing of the system, but doesn't change essentially the characteristic size of the particles. because the characteristic size of the particle is determined by the cyclotron radius. And when you vary the magnetic field, you do keep the density of the system fixed, so you keep the lattice spacing fixed, but what you change is the size of the particle. So in this experiment, you can really probe the two length scales, the two characteristic length scales that are important in this problem of disordered elastic systems. The second thing which is interesting is that essentially I told you that in the conventional wisdom the pinning frequency was determined by the length scale at which the displacement became of the order of the lattice spacing, and I call it RA. And in fact, it was something which was known since the work of Larkin for pinning of, let's say, vortex systems, that in fact, when you try to determine the critical currents, when you try to determine the pinning properties, the pinning, the critical current, is not determined by this length scale array, but is determined, I can see when people are sleeping because the computer, the table, you know, is moving here. And, okay, never mind. And the length scale that determines the critical current, the length scale that determines the pinning, is not the length scale array at which the displacement become of the order of the lattice spacing, but it's another length scale, which people call the Larkin of Shinnikov length, at which the displacement become of the order of the size of the particle. And therefore here, there is a question, which is what is the length scale that determines the pinning frequency, which is not the critical current, the critical force, the threshold field for depinning the Wigner crystal, but which is again a quantity that instinctively you feel should be related to the pinning. And when you do the variational solution, you do find that this pinning frequency is related to this Larkin of Shinnikov length scale RC. Which means that now, if you vary the magnetic field, if you vary the size of the particle, there will be an effect on the pinning frequency which you could not have got if you had assumed that the pinning frequency was controlled by the characteristic length scale at which the displacement became of the order of the lattice spacing, because this quantity is not affected by the magnetic field. So now when you do the correct theory, you find that because of this dependence of the pinning frequency in the magnetic field through this length scale RC, the pinning frequency might, because it depends on the relative size of the particle towards the correlation length of the disorder, but at least there are regimes where the pinning frequency can increase with the magnetic field, which is again in decent agreement with the experiment. And finally, again, when you put the characteristic length scales in the pinning frequency, you find that the pinning frequency decreases as a function of the density as n to the power minus 3/2, which is pretty decently consistent with what was measured experimentally. Right. Yep.
Does it mean that correct theory of this omega cannot be done in framework of classical physics? So you have to do something quantum mechanical on small scale, right? If you introduce this scale, which is basically Bohr radius, then what do you say?
I don't know whether I want to answer yes or no, because I could say I get a quote classical crystal, but whose size of the particle is fixed by the cyclotron radius.
I guess my question is, of course, if you will play this particles with finite size, yes, you will get it.
Yes.
I mean that, but it is not just solid balls.
No, but you see, this is the way this has been treated here. They essentially have been treated as solid balls with a typical length scale, with a typical size LC, and this seems to work not too bad. The only quantum aspects here are in quantizing the vibrations of this crystal. But the nature of the wave function for each particle has been forgotten in this description. Now, my feeling, but again, I've no, it's more a feeling than something I can prove, is that when one is deep in the crystal phase, the precise shape of wave function is not really important, and one can treat the particle as solid balls. Where this will become drastically important is when you will approach melting.
I'm saying that when radius of this particle is zero, then there is no
spinning for
No, 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 no. I'm not saying that. I'm saying quite.
Go to quite, the limit when radius of the particle is zero.
Sure, because if you go to the to this limit, then the size that will control RC will be not the size of the particle anymore, but will be the correlation length of the disorder itself. Okay. So when the size of the particle will become smaller than the correlation length of the disorder, then there is a crossover in this regime. So in principle, you can describe also a system with particle as small as you want with this description. By the way, this poses a question in this system, which is what is the typical correlation length for the disorder? As far as I know, nobody knows how to answer this question. For some issues, it's not really important. In particular, for the density dependence, it has absolutely no consequence. But for the dependence in magnetic field, it's more of a crucial issue. So this is something that one would like to know in this system, is whether one can consider that the disorder is uncorrelated at typical length scale, which is smaller than the cyclotron radius, or not. And this is clearly an open question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
When particle size is larger.
Okay,
right.
This is not caring about this issue. So it will be valid for both cases. The fact that omega p increases with the magnetic field is valid if the size of the particle, so the cyclotron radius, is larger than the correlation length of the disorder. If you go to the other limit, where the correlation length of the disorder is larger, then the pinning frequency should decrease with the magnetic field. So if you tell me that in the system where they observe an increase of the pinning frequency with magnetic field, the correlation length of the disorder is 10 times the size of the cyclotron radius, then there is still something to understand in this system in that respect. Yeah.
Why do you say that the correlation length of the disorder is so mysterious? I mean, the standard picture is that the disorder comes from remote ionized donors, and then you say that the correlation length is about the thickness of the spacer layer, and so in high mobility samples that can actually be quite large.
Yeah. Yes and no. I have heard this argument every time, and what can I say? I'm not totally convinced by it, in the sense that yes, this is the conventional argument. This is the ionized object, this is a Coulomb potential, and then essentially the correlation length of the potential will be the distance to the donor layer. But is it really true? I mean, because this can be a gigantic distance. This can be even larger than the lattice spacing in the system. Let me be more precise in what I mean. Here, when I talk about disorder, the disorder has to be decomposed in Fourier component with respect to the lattice spacing of the system itself. And in fact, the Q equals zero component of the disorder, meaning some Fourier component of the disorder that are much larger than the lattice spacing, have absolutely no impact on the physical property of the system. This is something that will give you a standard elastic contribution. So essentially, you get your elastic Hamiltonian, and then you get something which is some disorder, which will couple to the, I would say, standard elastic deviation of the density in the system that you can write as a gradient of the displacement. And this part of the disorder can be totally absorbed in the quadratic part, and you can check that it's not changing, for example, the transport property at all. It's a little bit like in localization in one dimension, forward scattering is not doing anything. And what really counts are the Fourier component of the disorder that are closely matching or close to the periodicity of the original crystal. And it's totally unclear to me what is the correlation length for this Fourier component of the disorder, because the one you're mentioning will certainly enter this one. And there, you know, it doesn't matter. They can be correlated. They are, in fact, correlated on 10,000 lattice spacing, but they are having absolutely no effect on the system. So what you really would like to have are the correlation lengths of the Fourier component of the disorder that have a wave vector which is close to 1 over A, where A is the lattice spacing. And so far, I don't know what is the correlation length of these guys. And the argument, the standard argument, doesn't give you this.
Well, at least you can calculate it in that model of remote ionized
bonus. Okay. Maybe. Maybe you can calculate it. I don't know. No, no, I mean, what I mean is that I've never seen, maybe I'm guilty for not doing it, but I've never seen in the literature an analysis of the correlations of this part of the disorder. And again, let me emphasize that it is crucial to decompose the disorder in this Fourier component. And again, if you did only keep the Fourier component of the disorder, that is the one at Q equals zero, you would find that essentially crystal exists above two dimensions, whereas, you know, again, we know since Larkin that crystal don't exist when you put disorder. So it might be simply slightly subtler, more subtle than what one naively thinks. But okay, we can discuss that maybe in more detail. Okay. In any case, let me again emphasize that for the density dependence of the pinning frequency, this issue of relative size of the cyclotron radius towards the correlation length of the disorder is not entering anymore. So my personal feeling, I'm much more happy with experiment probing the density dependence of these quantities than the magnetic field, for other reasons also that I can mention.
Your theoretical results seem to show shoulder and then even go up.
Yes.
Whereas, of course, experimentally, I have not much of a shoulder now.
Yes. Okay. The reason why this curve go up here is the following reason: that when you put the strong magnetic field, in fact, I told you that for the pure system, you had a peak at omega c, which is the cyclotron frequency. Now, if you put the pinning, you will have another peak at the pinning frequency, and therefore the complete structure is something like this. Now, in the experiment, the tails are cut, so they don't care about what is happening at the cyclotron frequency here. For this particular curve, the upturn is stretching to reach the cyclotron frequency. Of course, if you didn't have the magnetic field, then this second peak would not exist here, and then you would get a simple decrease here. Okay, so there are puzzles that the at least this stage of theory is not able to explain, and I just want to mention them to you. The first one is that the actual experiment looking at the magnetic field dependence see a broadening that is opposite with the one that is seen predicted by the theory. You can see that essentially the further you go in frequency, okay, this is density dependence, but this is not changing very much. This is also what you see in the experimental plots when you do the density dependence. The higher the pinning frequency, the broader the peaks. Whereas when the magnetic field experiment is done, the peak becomes narrower when the pinning frequency increases, which is contrary to what the theory would give you, and again, which is contrary to what the density dependence peak shows. So there are, again, two solutions to this. Either there is something that we miss in the theory, or, and this is personally more my feeling, the experiments that did the magnetic field are very close to the boundary of the melting, and they are also at temperature which are quite high. So when you move the pinning frequency up, it's quite possible that you lose part of thermal broadening of the peaks, and that's why the peak could become narrower. Or it's also possible that you move further away from the melting, because you crank up the magnetic field, the melting boundary of the Wigner crystal, and therefore the peak become narrower. So I certainly would love to see the magnetic field experiment repeated at smaller temperatures and far away from the boundary. But at least, again, in the density experiment, the broadening of the peak goes in a way that is consistent with what the theory would predict, which is that when the pinning frequency goes up, the peak would become broader. There is another puzzle, which is not a puzzle from the experiment, but which is a puzzle from the theory. When you compute with this variational method the Hall resistivity, what you find is that essentially the Hall resistivity is the classical value. You have disorder, you have interactions, you have whatever you want, and you find the Hall resistivity, which is stupidly the classical value. So there is probably something deep behind it. I don't know what it is, but this is what the calculation give you. Finally, let me mention that we can compute the compressibility, and the compressibility has a sort of interesting behavior, is that if you compute really the compressibility that you love and like, which is the compressibility at omega n equals zero, the Matsubara frequency equals zero, which in principle is the thermodynamic compressibility, you find that the compressibility of the system is essentially unaffected by the disorder. So if you have no Coulomb interaction, it's a constant. If you have Coulomb interaction, it's zero, because you cannot compress the system. But what is interesting is that if instead of computing the compressibility at zero frequency, you compute the compressibility when the frequency goes to zero, keeping Q fixed, taking first the frequency goes to zero, and then taking Q to zero, as any textbook would gently tell you to do, this is a mistake, this should be zero, you find that now the compressibility is zero. So essentially, it means that if instead of trying to measure thermodynamical equilibrium, you apply a very smallly varying field, then you find that your system does not respond at all. I don't know, but my feeling is that this is somehow related to the phenomenon of Coulomb glass, of Coulomb gap that one gets, which is that if you take electrons plus interaction plus disorder, you get a dip in the density of state that is tied to the Fermi surface, and which is obviously not something which is thermodynamics, because otherwise, if you shifted the Fermi level, then this gap would not move. So it looks more like a dynamical effect, and again, this is something that seems to pop up in this variational solution. Finally, since my time is running out, let me mention that all what I've told you has been derived from an elastic theory. So you could tell me that, in fact, this is whole garbage, because normally, if this crystal was breaking into crystallites and there were these dislocations and defects, I should have also included them in my elastic description of the crystal, and the defects could change the transport. After all, dislocation can migrate in the crystal and so on and so forth. Well, the good thing is that this vision of a crystal plus disorder is completely wrong. And it's possible to prove it, and in fact, although this length scale array at which the displacement become of the order of the lattice spacing exists, it doesn't mean that the crystal breaks into crystallites. It doesn't mean that dislocation appear. And in fact, in D equal 3, one can show that there is a phase which is a disordered phase, which we call bright glass, in which the system is disordered as a characteristic length scale at which dislocation become of the order of the lattice spacing, and still no topological defects, no dislocation appear. In D equal 2, the situation is slightly less good. So dislocations are generated by the disorder, but the main point is that they are generated at length scale, which are much, much larger than the typical distance array at which the displacements become of the order of the lattice spacing. Now, what are the consequences of that? The consequence of that is that if the old vision of the crystal had been correct, then the peak here would be controlled by this length scale array, and dislocations, defects, would occur at the same length scale. So all this part of the optical conductivity would be completely wrong. One would need dislocation to correctly get it. But now we know that this peak is controlled by RC, which is the length at which the displacement are of the order of the size of the particle, which is smaller than the lattice spacing. So the length scale array corresponds to smaller frequencies, and the dislocations appear at larger scales than this length scale array, which means that the whole pinning peak is unaffected by defects. So the elastic theory is giving quantitatively the optical transport. It's giving quantitatively the optical conductivity, the point even in D equal 2 where there are topological defects. If one could do a Wigner crystal in D equal 3, then this problem would not occur because in D equal 3 there would be no topological defect. Unfortunately, the corollary of that is that if you want to have the DC transport, you need to take into account the defects. And therefore, we are not yet in a shape that allows us to really describe the DC transport. I won't talk about the dynamics. We can always talk about it. Let me flash some transparencies. I'm kidding. And jump to conclusions. So what I tried to describe to you today is a sort of elastic description of the two-dimensional electron gas plus disorder. And I hope to have shown you that at least if one starts from the crystal phase, we have very good tools to tackle this problem now. We have a good starting description, but what is important is that now we have sort of theoretical tool that enable us to extract reliable solution from this elastic description of the Wigner crystal. For both the static properties, the positional order, and the AC transport, this elastic description is enough. And as you saw, now there is good agreement with the experiment, which at least suggests that in these systems that were observed in the Princeton group and in the Sackley group, when indeed as a Wigner crystal, and I would love to see similar experiment done on, I would say, two-dimensional electron gas without magnetic field, because clearly these are probes that can tells us that whether the insulating phase in this system is a Wigner crystal or not. So I would love to have in this system the optical conductivity data that has been performed. Of course, there are many things that we don't understand and which are still completely open and I think relatively exciting issues. The main one is the issue of defects in the crystal, dislocations, vacancies interstitial. In 3D, one is lucky, they are not there. This is this so-called Bragg-Last phase. But in 2D, they will be there at large enough length scale, and they are controlling the DC transport. So if we want to have a chance to understand the DC transport, even in the crystal phase, we need to deal with the dislocations. And of course, they are also likely to be important if you want to know how this crystal is destroyed. So if you want to go to the left now, if you want to go from the crystal phase towards the electron gas, you will have to include these defects. Of course, the melting is complicated because if you go to the melted crystal, then the fermionic nature of the particle is again important, and we cannot neglect it anymore. There is one thing that one would love to do. It's the nonlinear transport in the quantum case. For the classical case, we have good tools to do it. For the quantum case, it's a tough cookie, but people are working on it. So I hope that there will be answers in the near future. And finally, I didn't insist too much on that, but these systems, which are disordered elastic system, I told you there is replica symmetry breaking, and for people who know, this means that they are glasses. So if they are glasses, they will exhibit a lot of goodies that glasses have, and one of them is so-called aging, which means that the response of the system will depend on the time at which you have applied the perturbation. So this is clearly some things that could be probed in this Wigner crystal that would be interesting to analyze further. Okay, so I think on that I will stop. Thank you for your attention.
Questions? You mentioned you ended up with a solution with replica symmetry breaking, but you didn't expand on that. What are the implications of that replica symmetry breaking on the result?
Okay. That's a good question. It's a variational method, so strictly speaking, the implications are zero, because you could say it's an artifact of your variational method. You know, after all, you choose a saddle point which is replica symmetry broken, but this is because you have taken the wrong variational approach. In this case, we have good reason for various reasons. The first one is that we know that this system have glassy behavior. The second one is that we have other solutions. One is the renormalization group solution that I have not talked about, and the third one is a dynamical solution to know that this system are glasses. So the replica symmetry breaking that appears in the variational approach is the signature that this system have glassy behavior. So they have metastable states, they have barriers, growing barriers separating these metastable states, as you know, spin glasses have, as standard glasses have.
How is that reflected in the transport?
Okay, in the frequency dependence, you do not see it too much. If you wanted to see the glassy structure, a good way would be to do the IV characteristics. For example, I don't know if you can see on this side of the blackboard. Yeah, but let me, for example, give you what happened for a classical crystal, because for there we have the solution. If you plotted the velocity versus force characteristics at t equals zero, you would have this critical force which says that the system is not moving, which tells you that the omega equals zero, if you want, response is zero. At finite temperature, you would of course have a response because you can always pass barrier by thermal activation. But the response here would be highly nonlinear. So it would be 1 over F to some power. So this is one of the way that this glassy nature of the system manifests itself. And the reason why you get this is because you get divergent barriers that grow when you lower the force that you apply on it. For the quantum crystal, the equivalent curve is not known at the moment, but there is likely to be the same type of properties that will manifest themselves. Yes?
Coming back to this question or indication of this Coulomb gap, I mean, it seems to me that this, in this elastic theory, the only place where Coulomb interaction actually enters is sort of in the mode frequencies of the
yes.
Problem. And
yes.
It didn't seem, I mean, you needed the Q to the 3/2. I mean,
The Q to the 3/2.
Coulomb interaction actually enter.
Well, Coulomb interaction enter because when you look at the longitudinal mode, this guy has a dispersion which is essentially Q. Okay? So when you compute the compressibility, this is important. Yeah. This is important. The Q to the 3/2 comes from the fact that you make diagonalize the matrix because of the Lorentz force. And when the cyclotron energy is the largest energy in the system, this makes a sort of square root between this omega equal Q, omega square equal Q, and the omega square equal Q square dispersion for the transverse modes. But when you have disorder, all this is in principle changed. So for the compressibility, the longitudinal mode is the one that counts. Yeah.
What are the physical processes that are responsible for your result that the whole resistivity takes the classical effect?
Gee, I would love to answer this in a physical way. The only thing I can tell you is that we take the variational solution, we compute the whole resistivity, and it turns out to be the classical value. There might be a way to understand it in the sense that we take an elastic theory, so the crystal is all linked together, and after all, you could say that when the system is sliding and responding to the magnetic field, the total number of electrons will respond, and that's the only thing that counts. But again, I have no simple way to explain to you why the whole resistivity takes the classical value. It just comes out of the calculation of the system. By the way, there is one thing that you have to realize, is that what we did is a calculation which is essentially a t equals zero calculation, and we take then the limit omega goes to zero, and there the variational method is I would say difficult to attack on this. But of course, when you measure the whole resistivity, what you sort of do is that you're at omega equals zero and t different from zero. Whether this inversion of limit would change something is complicated. What is measured experimentally, by the way, is the classical value.
It's no linear hole, right? There is no linear hole existing in this limit. T equals to 0, and omega equals to 0.
No, there is. There is. If you take the standard all resistivity, you find that the powers of omega cancel and give you a linear whole resistivity.
What about linear resistivity?
But, I mean, you know, you compute rho xy, and you find that it goes to a constant. So sigma xx is going to 0 as omega square.
Oh, okay.
But sigma xy is also going to 0 with the proper power of omega in the way that when you compute rho xy, the powers of omega vanish, and this is giving you a constant. But this is 0 divided by 0, if you want. And again, if you were at finite temperature, then it's different objects that will, again, dominate the DC transport, like, again, the defects and whatever. So I'm not sure that this is related to what is observed experimentally. But even in this limit, I have no simple explanation for what is measured.
What does your theory predict for cycles and resonance
frequency? That's a good question. I don't have it in my head, but we computed it. I mean, it's there is some broadening for the cyclotron peak, but I would be.
Will it go up with or down?
The cyclotron peak? Well, cyclotron frequency is. The broadening. With the field. Okay, I don't know, but I can look it up and tell you. We have mostly concentrated on the pinning frequency peak because this is the one that has been measured. The cyclotron peak is at very high frequencies, but the theory, of course, gives you the full curve. So I can, if you give me half a day, I can give you the answer.
What about the heat capacity?
That's a good question. The problem is that measuring the heat capacity, computing the heat capacity is more complicated because you would have to go through essentially the free energy of the system, and the free energy of the system with the replica symmetry breaking is a sort of nightmare. So we didn't have the guts to compute it. I would love to have the two-level system type response that one would expect, so sort of linear heat capacity. But it's something that was on the back of my mind for a long time, but we never had the guts to really do it. It's not clear, by the way, that the variational approach will be as good for the free energy itself than it would be for the Green's function. But it's certainly something which is worth to try. So it's all mistake not to have tried it.
So maybe you should try the thermal conductivity.
Yes. Except I don't know any experiments of thermal conductivity that have been done on this system. So yes, maybe one can compute the thermal conductivity. That's maybe something interesting. You see, the point is that the transport is relatively easy to compute because the current itself is essentially simply the time derivative of the displacement. So essentially, the Kubo formula is the Green's function, and once you do the variational approach, you do have instantly the conductivity. If you have more sophisticated objects, they are. First, it's more complicated to compute, but that's not, of course, a good reason. But it's also maybe less likely that the variational method correctly captures the things associated with it. Again, DC, let me insist on that, DC transport will need the inclusion. We need to take into account probably the defects of the crystal. DC current. I'm not sure that for the heat transport, because you can probably also transport heat through the crystal itself, you need that. But for the current, standard current, one needs to have the defects. So I don't know whether heat capacity would be meaningful, but that's a good suggestion.
Suggestion.
Yeah.
I mean, could you try to calculate the electron tunneling density states?
Oh,
you expand your crystal globally.
Okay, let me give you an answer. I would like to answer no, and this no is based but this no is based on 1D. So maybe it's not a good reason, because all what I've presented to you in two dimension, you can also do in one dimension. And what is nice is that in one dimension, I don't know if I made a test, how many of you would think about the Lettinger liquid as an elastic theory, but this is all what it is. If you take a one-dimensional electron gas plus interaction, it's described in terms of a Lettinger liquid, and what is the Hamiltonian of a Lettinger liquid? It's something which is exactly an elastic theory. So all what I've presented to you can be used in one dimension to study Anderson localization plus interaction on one-dimensional electrons. And it works pretty well. It reproduces the result of the renormalization group that we did with Einschulz. It gives you the localized properties. It works very well. The problem is that this variational method works well when you deal with the field phi itself. The tunneling density of state involves the single electron operator, which contains both the field phi and the dual variable theta. And you can easily check that when you do a variational approach, let me do sine Gordon, for example, and do cosine phi here. The variational approach in this case would simply replace cosine by phi square. And this is pretty good, as long as you don't have theta, because theta is creating solitons in the phase phi. And when you have a cosine, of course, it doesn't cost you any energy to make a soliton except there. But if I replace the cosine by phi square, then all this part will cost me a finite amount of energy. So the correlation function of these guys will turn out to be, with this approach here, exactly zero. So unless we have a variational approach that can deal with the dual field, my impression is that we are not in a good shape to compute the single particle tunneling density of state, or, for example, superconducting correlation functions in one dimension. But maybe in two dimension things are better. But
isn't it just that you've built in the connectivity of the lattice?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, because clearly if you were in the phase where this cosine was not relevant, the variational method would correctly give you this correlation function. I think it's just because you're making the assumption that essentially the phase phi, or the displacement in two dimension, can only do small expansion, small displacement around some equilibrium position. And what the variational method is very good at giving you, good timing. So why don't we turn off this? I wanted to raise the screen in any case. Let me stop this, and maybe we can. No, that's okay. Don't worry. It should do it itself. Now, so what I wanted to can I turn this up? Power off. Yep. Good. So what I wanted to say is that what the variational method is pretty good
at the,
press again. Yeah. So what the variational method is pretty good at giving you is the fact that you would get phi that will get pinned in random position as a function of x, and it generates for you the static solution, and then it generates for you the spring constants to take into account the fact that you can make oscillations with different spring constant at different positions. And this is what, for example, the one-step replica symmetry breaking does very well for you. You can check that what this method is doing is that it generates a distribution of seed states, of equilibrium states, and a distribution of spring constants that around which you will make your oscillations. But it also means that you completely miss the possibility of making solitonic excitations. And we played for a while to try to see whether we could sort of, I don't know, villainize the cosine, you know, to keep the solitons. But so far we have not been very successful with it. So as any time where there is some dual field, or any time you want to compute something which is a soliton type excitation, there are good reasons at least not to believe the results of the variational method. And again, this has nothing to do with disorder. You can do it for Sine-Gordon, simple Sine-Gordon theory.
Okay, well, questions, let's stop here again.
Thank you.